Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Crutella and Delina Harper, LMSW, for their discussion on There Is Always Hope. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome to our Alchemical Dialogues. Delina, hi.
Hello.
I'm so glad you could make it and that you agreed to do this.
I appreciate you asking me. Thank you.
You're welcome. We have a book club and we read your book and we're going to talk about it again after the podcast next month. There's people that are interested. Some of them couldn't make it to the recording. So just for people who don't know, Delina is a licensed master social worker living in Minnesota now, right?
Yes.
You're the director of Hope Harbor and Harvest Hill programs at the Salvation Army in Minneapolis. And I believe you primarily work with the homeless.
Yeah, formerly homeless.
Before then, you were director of the Spiritus Christi Prison Outreach Jennifer House in Rochester, New York, where you yourself had been a resident in 2006. And you're an alumna of Monroe Community College in Rochester, Nazareth College, and the Greater Rochester Collaborative of SUNY College at Brockport. I got introduced to you through Kathleen, who you worked with briefly when you were doing your social work training, right?
Yes, I was interning with her. She was my intern supervisor.
Right. She mentioned what a story you had and what a great person you were. And then your book came out and I read your book and it was, you know, it is so open and revealing. And the word that I used in talking to my friends about it is it's just really honest and raw. It's just out there. And then you've done remarkable things. I mean, 3/4 of the book is like, how is this woman alive?
The struggle.
Yeah. And then the turnaround was really dramatic. I'm not sure about how fast the turnaround was, maybe, but what you've been able to do is really amazing. So anyways, for people, before I forget, the book is God's Teardrop by Delina Harper, and you can get it on Amazon or your... It's out in ebook format too, right?
Yes.
Right. I have the paperback. Can you talk a little bit about, I don't even know where to start, a little synopsis of the struggles you had that you eventually had to deal with and overcome?
It was the struggle of the results of the choices that I was making. And I want to say that I know you said that the turnaround, it wasn't quick. And I think that anything that's worth keeping takes time, because it's been my experience when I get things really quickly, I don't appreciate it and I take advantage of it and then I lose it, only to get it again and lose it again. So when things come to me slowly, I appreciate them more. That's how my life has been, you know, because I grew up in a 2-parent home. My parents are still married to this day. We were in the suburbs. I had everything that I wanted. I grew up with this level of self-hatred because of the color of my skin and the area that we were in and the bullying that I've experienced. At that age, you just, all human beings just want to be accepted. They just want to belong, you know, and I just felt out of place because of the color of my skin. And I'm not even that dark, but I was the darkest thing in Cottage Grove, mm-hmm. Minnesota. And by the way, we say Minnesota, not just Minnesota, but Minnesota.
Minnesota? Okay.
At least that's how they say it in the movie Fargo. So I grew up with this level of self-hatred, and I had some experiences where I went from hating myself and thinking I was nothing all the way to, we can't curse. So thinking I was nothing to thinking I was like the bomb. I was everything. There was no in between, no humility, mm-hmm. you know, and you got to have a balance. And that just kind of messed me up. And when I found drugs, I found like acceptance and that I belonged in that lifestyle. And we all know that like other things in life, other addictions, that they lie and it's an illusion. And I fell for it and I wanted more. It was like a relationship that I had with the drugs, a bad, unhealthy relationship that kind of just beat me up, but I kept going back to it and I couldn't leave it. And it was just the struggle of that. And it got to the point where that became the most important thing in my life. Drugs consumed my life, and anything that got in the way of me getting high had to go, including my daughter, including myself. I lost all respect for myself. You know, I hear a lot of people say they lost all this material stuff. Yeah, you do lose material stuff when you're using like I use. But I lost myself. I lost Delina, the self-respect that I had, the dignity, the integrity, all of that internal stuff, you know, and I wore a lot of masks. Everywhere I went, I was whoever I needed to be to get my next fix, you know, and I would come up with these different names. I remember being in Texas when I was in prison. I was, I think it was Paper Doll. And then I've been D Baby and Baby D. In Chicago, I was Reality, and I was so far from reality, you know, and it's so crazy because people are like, what's your name? And I'm like, hi, I'm Reality. Like, I look back at that today and I just laugh like, you were really silly. Like, that was just silly. So I just came up with the whoever I wanted to be. And then like when I put the drugs down, I didn't know who I was, you know? So this process of recovery has kind of like been a discovery. Well, I had to uncover some things to discover who I was, you know, because I didn't know who I was. The drugs just really did a number. And the things that I did totally went against all the morals and values that my parents instilled in me. It's like when I grew up, I had morals and values that were instilled in me. They were positive examples of my life. And when I moved to the street lifestyle, like that's a whole new code of ethics, or it's like survival of the fittest, do or die. You're not honest out there. You can't be honest and loving and caring, but I found ways to be that even in active addiction. So while I was in that lifestyle, while I was in the wilderness, but it was a lot of just ups and downs as a result of the ways and means that I went through to get the drugs.
Right.
That was the struggle, getting the drugs.
And you used a variety of drugs, correct?
Yes. Mainly it was crack cocaine, but it was pretty much whatever you had, you know, because it's something about taking a substance to like not feel, because I would rather not feel, because when I was feeling, I was feeling all this guilt and shame. And in order not to feel, I would get high again. And alcohol would do that. Marijuana would do that. Anything that would take me out of myself, that's what I wanted. And so like in recovery, our feelings is what makes us human, I believe. As long as I'm feeling, I know I'm okay. I may not like what I'm feeling. To me, feelings aren't good and bad feelings. It's what we do with those feelings that makes them good or bad. So because we all get angry, it's a human emotion, but it's how I respond to that anger is what makes it bad. So just sitting, being able to sit with my feelings and not act out on them inappropriately, kind of like I did yesterday when I went off on the social worker because I was fearful for my father. So I acted out. And most of the time, you know, I try to, and I think we have a daily reprieve. We're only human, but I do my best to sit with my feelings and just kind of process them. And that is so uncomfortable, just to sit with feelings, with grief, with anger, with hurt, with sadness, with embarrassment. Our feelings, we tend to react to them instead of respond.
It was a paper that I read when I was a practicing psychiatrist, and I don't think it had to do with substance abuse. It did have to do with people who are incarcerated. And I can't remember the title of the paper, but the point they made is the first step towards the possibility of real change and treatment is when the person becomes anxious.
Yes.
Saying that what was happening is the lifestyle they had that got them into prison, a lot of it had to do with blocking anxiety.
Yes.
And feeling like what most of us would call, like you just mentioned, what happened yesterday with your dad and the social worker. Things happen, or you get a normal feeling of anxiety given, you know, nothing outrageous. But it might have been people who were using drugs. To them, the least bit of anxiety felt absolutely overwhelming.
It is. When you go from not feeling to feeling, and then you don't know what you're feeling, that's scary. It's consuming. It's overwhelming because you don't even know what you're feeling. And one of the things that we would do at the Jennifer House is teach. Well, they taught me how to label my feelings. We had this feeling sheet. And some people would say, like, I'm good. And good is not a feeling. What are you feeling? And so we were able to like look at all these feelings. Some of the feeling sheets had these faces. So if I didn't know what the word was, I can look at the face and say, oh, that's bewilderment. But we learned to label our feelings and identify them. And then they helped us to express them appropriately. Some of us don't even express them. And then if they get bottled up, they come out sideways.
Right. You know, you're an intelligent woman. And you're saying you needed a chart to help identify a feeling.
Yes, to help identify a feeling.
Right. That's really impressive that it could be buried that much. And I wanted to get back. I don't know who listens to the podcasts. I know in our recordings, the people who come like today are all white.
Yes.
You're a Black woman. And I don't want to skip over this. I want to go back. You came from... It sounds like a loving household, parents who were together, you got what you needed, you lived in suburbia, and because of your skin color, you felt that you didn't fit in and you were bullied.
Yes.
Could you talk some more about that?
So I would come home asking my mother what a jigaboo is. I knew what a nigger was, but like I'm talking 8, 9, 10 years old, being called these names, mm-hmm. you know. And getting messages from teachers that I will never amount to anything. Teachers trying to put me in special reading classes because they get money for putting minorities in these special classes. Mm-hmm. I'm a great reader. Always have been. Love to read.
Even as a child in school then.
Yeah. Thank God my mother didn't go for that. But, you know, just coming home, asking my mom, like, I never heard the word jigaboo. And she was like, where are you hearing these words from? It was from what the kids were calling me at school. And obviously, at that age, they were learning that from their parents. I mean, it was just things like that. And just being ostracized, you know, and just children, just they're all hanging together at the lunch. I can't sit with anybody. I gotta go sit alone. Because nobody wants to sit with me. Mm-hmm. But then when I, this was an elementary school, and then I went to the junior high school and I found comfort at like hanging with the druggies. I wasn't doing drugs all the time, but like they were the only group of people that accepted me. So I would hang with them, the outcast. So I've kind of always been an outcast. But then I went to school in the city where they praised me for my hair, my skin color, and my lips. I got kicked out of that school and I went to Park Cottage Grove here in Minnesota, the high school in the suburbs where I grew up at. And all the kids that were calling me those names, like Black was in. It was cool to be Black. Rap was out. Hip hop was in. And so now they wanted to be my friend because I was Black, not because of me and who I was and my characteristics, but because of my skin color. And I'm looking at them like, you are the same person that tormented me, pulling my hair in the desk behind me, calling me these names. And now you just think we're just cool like that? Like, no. So it was things like that. But I think since I've been in recovery, I'm used to being the minority because I've always been, and especially in Rochester, the boards and the things that I sat on, I was always the youngest, the only female, and the darkest thing there. So I was always with these older white men. And I would have a conversation going on in my head while during the comp, like, what am I doing here? You don't belong. You're out of place. What do you have to offer? but some of them, most of them did a really good job at including me in the conversations and kind of empowering me and help building my self-esteem. I had some really good mentors. There were some that just didn't get it. And by that time, I had a voice and I was able to like, hey, that's wrong. That's racism, or that statement is not an accurate statement. And they felt uncomfortable. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does to a point. So I bet people on the call, when they were in elementary school, either saw bullying or may have experienced bullying themselves, or maybe we even bullied other people. And I was bullied very little. It was really early in elementary school because I was overweight. I was shy.
You?
Yeah.
Shy?
I know. It's amazing. It's quite a transformation. You do a podcast with me sometime and we'll talk about
okay.
But I saw other kids being bullied, and it was an all-white school. We didn't have any, certainly no Black people. It was a Catholic school. So I met my first Jewish person in high school because I went to a Catholic high school, all boys, no Black people, and three Jewish boys because their parents, maybe it was two Jewish boys, because their parents wanted them to go to that school because it was a good school compared to the public school. I think they were accepted, but I remember the look on their faces because they were forced to sit in religion class. They didn't have to do homework, but they had to sit there and listen, which I remember thinking that was offensive somehow. But and then I met my first Protestant person in college, believe it or not, and I still didn't meet any Black people until I went to medical school in Nashville, Tennessee.
Wow.
I went to Vanderbilt. And the thing that bowled me over, I mean, I would see people on the street back when I was a kid. When I went to Vanderbilt, the first thing that hit me, I'm walking through the hospital and all the maintenance workers are Black, which is not the experience I had where I grew up in the Northeast, where they were mostly white, if not all white that I could remember. There were no Black kids in my class. There were a few women, not enough, but there were a few. The other part I remember is I was a curiosity because I was Northern and I was Italian. And that was well known and accepted. And I always thought, I think I'm accepted as a Northerner because there aren't a lot of me here. I always wonder what it would be if the North kind of invaded Vanderbilt Medical School. I had this feeling like one of me might be okay. Like in the board you're talking about in Rochester, it sounds really good. But I wonder if all of a sudden there were four of you instead of one of you, if that would feel a threat to the older white men or whether that would be accepted.
That's interesting. That's an interesting question. Yeah.
I mean, one of anything can be like a curiosity or, oh, it makes you feel good because you're accepting people. More than that, it starts to be, wait a minute, now you're a threat. How come there are so many of you?
Yeah.
But I don't know that. I don't know that for sure. I know, I remember we had this other experience in med school is we had one joint class that I can remember with people from Harry Medical College, which was primarily Black.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, the face I have in my mind was a white guy from Harry who was asking a question in a psychiatry class. And it was a pretty Freudian question because it was a pretty Freudian approach. And I understood, I mean, I wouldn't have asked the question, but I understood what he was talking about, and it's kind of right out of a textbook. I mean, the snide comments that were being made by the students, there was a clear, Vanderbilt was the place to go, and we clearly were very different than Meharry. And I never questioned it. I wondered about it, but it was really very clear.
Mm-hmm.
It was also clear about when you did your work as a medical student in the university hospital, which had Black patients as well as white patients. But you go to the general hospital, which was primarily Black and poorer clientele. And the treatment people got, not the medical treatment as much as the attitude.
I just experienced that with my dad this past week.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't remember the medical treatment being any better or worse.
It was just the attitude and just the way that they talked to me. And yeah, I just kept saying, just be nice, Delina, be nice. But like, I felt that better than less than. And then she found out that I was a social worker with a higher degree than her after she insulted me saying, well, I'm a social worker. What does that have to do with anything? Right. I'm just thinking, what I was thinking was, I'm a social worker too. You know, I got a license in 2 states, masters of social work. What does that have to do with my father's pneumonia?
If it makes you feel any better, I have a good friend who's an older white man. He's a psychiatrist and his father was in the hospital and he didn't like the care his father was getting. And I said, well, didn't you complain? And he said, Henry, I could have put on a clown suit and they still would have ignored me.
Yeah.
Part of what this brings up for me as an older white man is I've experienced it a little bit about ethnicity, a little bit about I was overweight as a kid and not athletic. I think there's something different when it's about your skin color. There's something different about that than when it's about class or, but being in the majority as a white male, I can't speak to that like you can. Do you think there's something that really goes deeper when it's about skin color?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that this country, this society really needs to come to terms with is the honest truth about slavery and segregation. We are living in the results of segregation and slavery. Like that hasn't even been addressed. You have people who deny it, who minimize it. And that's not to say like the Holocaust or something. Like I'm not comparing one was worse than the other. They were both horrific acts. Slavery is not acknowledged in school. It was like a little paragraph. Mm-hmm. I remember the paragraph. It was a paragraph in our history book. And like, that was my history, you know, and the way that she minimized it, it wasn't a big deal. Like, that's the message that I'm like, wow.
So you remember registering that as a child?
Yes. I mean, not seeing myself having to buy the dolls, the white Barbie dolls. And then when the black ones did come out, they weren't like the white ones. Not seeing myself represented on TV until the Cosby Show came out, right, or things like that. And usually it was like Good Times and the Jeffersons. That's why the Black Panther was so huge, because Black people don't have like a hero of their own there that represents them. That's why it was so huge. And that's why it was even more devastating when he died. And we're like, well, who's going to be Black Panther now? And I know these are like not real stuff. There's limited representation of people of color, especially when I was growing up. And then they had that movie Colors that came out with Ice-T and about the gangs in LA. And like, mm-hmm. That's how we were represented. You saw a Black person in a movie 10, 15, 20 years ago, they were always drug addicts, pimps, prostitutes, or they were never doctors. They were never lawyers, with the exception of the Cosby Show. They were never heroes. Like you just really didn't see that a lot. So yeah, it is different. And it's like demeaning. It kind of lessens, I feel it lessens our worth and our value. You know, even that study that was done, I forgot who did it with the children and the dolls, the black and white dolls. And they were asking the children, which one is the good one and which one is the bad one? And like devil's cake and angel food. So it's little subtle things like that just feed, it's like those subliminal messages. And it's just sad. Like my stepson is 8 years old. He is adorable. I love him. He's a sweetheart. He says the sweetest, now he can be a little terror and a minion, but mm-hmm. all kids can, you know, right. But like when he grows, I'm having this conversation with him that like, cause he's asking questions and telling him that like, because of the color of your skin, you are a threat to some people. You are a threat simply because of the color of your skin. And he doesn't understand that. So I shouldn't have to have these conversations with an 8-year-old, but we have to, because that's what today's society is. And it's unfortunate.
Again, when I think back, I had such a limited exposure. I agree with you. I remember the schooling in elementary and even high school where all that you said was minimized. I learned about white history, not about Black history. But I'm not sure that it sinks in. I know it intellectually, but not having lived through it. That's why I wanted to focus on this. And I really appreciate you doing this, that I can understand it. I can say I don't like it because I don't. I understand it intellectually. But to really feel how much that gets in when you're in a child, especially, I think it is easy for white people to not get it or to think they get it, but they only get it, like me, intellectually, but not having had that experience. Yeah. You know, it's more than, oh, you know, you were bullied. Well, so was so-and-so bullied. How come?
Yeah.
The bullying you had, like other black children, there's something really outrageous about that. That's more than, again, I don't want to compare bullying as bad no matter how you do it, but
yeah,
there's a level of intensity that really gets in. So for people who haven't read the book, I'm not kidding. When you read the book, you wonder how Delina is alive.
Hope.
Okay.
That's all I had to hold on to at times was hope.
What were you hoping for?
First, I was hoping that I would survive because I knew if I survived, I would always tell people, I know I'm crazy. I was going to say, call me crazy. I know I'm crazy, but I would literally be getting high, smoking crack, reading the Bible. And people would tell me that I am going to hell for that. That's blasphemy. And I would say, why? This is when I need him the most. I knew that if I survived, I was going to do something with my life. I was going to be somebody. All I had to do was survive. I knew that. I don't know how I knew that. I just knew.
That's what I was going to ask you.
And I know that, like, I would have these dreams, and I talk about them in the book, where I would get these messages. I looked at them as messages from God that I was going to be okay. One dream was I was in a car in the back seat and somebody had fell out and I was about to fall out and I was falling and like the trees were hitting the door. And then it was like the last minute, right before I fell, I pulled myself up or somebody pulled me up. I can't remember, but I made it. And I took that as to be, I'm going to fall really long and really hard, but I will make it. I will be okay. And then there was another dream where my dad was in the dream, and my dad doesn't use at all, but he appeared in the dream that he used, and we were getting ready to leave, and he was getting ready to leave and go get high, and he thought I was going with him. And I told him, no, I think I'm going to stay. And he came over to me and he put my hoodie on my head and tied it. And he said, you're going to be okay. And in my mind, I took that as God the Father. So my dad represented God the Father, and God was telling me I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy that I say that because my daughter and I, you know, we went to go see an astrologer last year on my birthday. And she said that my psychic abilities come in my dreams, which I thought was like, that's boring. My psychic abilities come in my dreams. That is so boring. Why can't it be like, I don't know, only when I'm sleeping, I'm psychic? Like, what do I do with that? But it just kind of clicked that, wow, I get those messages. So, and that's just what I believe. And whether it's true or not, that's what I believe. And sometimes that's all you have to hold on to is your beliefs and hope. And like, I just knew that I was going to be clean one day.
So when you and I were talking before the podcast, just getting to know each other, I said to you, I don't know if you remember, that I'm reading your book and I'm thinking, okay, I practiced for 30, 40 years as a psychiatrist. And if I had been somebody who was trying to help you, I don't know if I could have stuck with you.
I couldn't have. We all know you can't help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. And it was like, that's how caught up I was in the grips. You know, I have family members right now that are actively using. I worry about them. I love them. And I'll just let them know that I'm thinking about them every now and then on their birthdays, around holidays. And I don't want anything. I just send them to, I love you. And I'm just thinking about you. And mm-hmm. That's it. And when you're ready, you know where to come for help, you know, because I know that they can be prayed over, the holy water, a seance. You can do anything. But if somebody is not willing to stop using, there is absolutely nothing you can do. Like, I know that nobody was stopping me from using. I got locked in houses with dogs on the outside, and I still got out and went and got high. I love dogs.
Any thoughts about how to help people not be so judgmental when they're working with somebody who's in the grips of addiction like you were?
So it's so easy to say, you know, just do this and just do that. You just kind of have to accept people right where they are, but just love them just as they are, their flaws and all. And I think what really helps someone to not be so judgmental is to work on themselves. The more that I work on myself and the more that I become aware of my beliefs and all of this, the more I practice self-acceptance, I'm able to accept others just as they are. The more I accept my flaws, I'm able to accept the flaws of others, because everything starts with me and it ends with me. When I see stuff in other people that I don't like or that doesn't bother me, I really need to take a look at me and see what's going on with me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also understand that, like, we're all children of God. And that's just the bottom line. I have clients right now that, oh my God, they drive me nuts. And just some days I can handle them and most days I can't, but I still love them at the end of the day. I mean, I get called the B word, I don't know how many times a day. And then 5 minutes later, they come back and ask me for something and I'm willing to help them. So, and it's just really, I guess, taking the high road and walking in love. And the more that I work on myself with the self-acceptance and just accepting Delina as I am and the self-awareness, the more I'm able to meet people right where they're at, just as they are.
So you think your spiritual beliefs helped you hold on to knowing that you had those qualities in you, that if you just survived,
yes,
you'd be able to come out?
People would always tell me that there's something about you. You shouldn't be out here. There's something about you. And I'm like, nobody should be out here, you know, but you're special. And I'm like, well, when somebody can tell me what that is, let me know. Somebody did tell me that you still have love, because out there in the streets, a lot of people don't fight with the person one day and then see them hungry the next day and buy them something to eat. And like, that's the type of person that I was. I never wanted to hurt anybody, but I did have to defend myself. And in the end, you know, the disease of addiction, I believe in the disease model. Disease of addiction had me doing things that I would never do. But I tend to hurt myself first before I would hurt somebody else. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what type of person I was. But I knew I still had love and I really had a genuine care for people, which was naive of me, that I just cared about people. Whether you harmed me yesterday, tomorrow, I just cared about people. Yeah, that got me in trouble a lot of times. But that's just how I was.
So I'm going to give a chance to people if they have any comments or questions before we go on to the next part.
You said you had dreams that kind of showed you that God was there for you and that you would come through this one way or another. Are you still having dreams that are helping you through life?
I do. And a lot of times, like when I wake up in the middle of the night, when I can't sleep and I can remember my dreams, I go online, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'm Googling the dream interpretation, or I just kind of meditate on it. I knew, and it's funny because I was sharing in a recovery meeting that something is going to happen with my dad. I don't know what it is, but I feel something is going to happen. And then all of this happened. I didn't know what it was, but I knew like it was going to be okay. And it's fearful because I love my dad. My dad is I'm a daddy's girl. So to answer your question, I still do. And I keep a notebook by my bed, which I always intend on using. But like, who wants to get up in the middle of the night and turn a light on? Like, I don't want to turn the light on, you know, because I really want to go back to sleep. So I intend to keep notes, but I do still have those dreams. I look at them as messages. I do.
Thank you. Bob, you have a question?
There are a number of places in the book, Delina, where you say, in one way or another, or at least I think you say, that you knew there would come a day when you would stop using.
Yes.
And that it wasn't yet. as you reported in the book, but was not yet. I was reminded about a quote from St. Augustine, who used to pray, "Lord, make me pure, but not yet." He led a rather raunchy life as a young man. And I didn't hear you praying that, but I heard you saying that. I wonder if you could talk a little more about that, because I can't get my head around being in that place. You know you're gonna, but you don't want to now.
So I just held on to God knowing my heart. God knew my heart. In Romans 7:14, in the Bible, I don't like know what everybody's faith is, but in the Bible, in Romans 7:14, it's something like, I do what I don't want to do instead of the things that I want to do because of the sin that lives in me. Like, I held on to that. I didn't use that as an excuse. A lot of people could, but like, it helped me to understand why I kept doing the things that I didn't want to do. And just the faith that I was going to do something different one day. And I would tell myself, like, I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know what it's going to take for me to stop using. And like I said, I just prayed that I survived, but not yet, you know, and but I, because I wanted to continue to use, and I needed to get it out of my system. Kind of like with anything, with kids, you just got to let them get it out of their system. So when they're in the car, they'll just go right to sleep. And that's kind of where I was. But I did a lot of praying, a lot of praying. And interesting that God would put good people in my life in active addiction. I hear people in my recovery program say they had no real friends out there. God put some good people in my life. Like, we would literally, I mean, we'd be getting high, but we would be having like Bible studies. So I held on to things like that. Like, who does that? That's crazy. But that's what we did. One of the things that I know, God doesn't use perfect people. Like, I think it was Noah that was a drunk. David was an adulteress and a murderer. Jonah was like, I'm not listening to you, and ended up in the belly of a whale.
I believe he doesn't use perfect people because there aren't any.
Exactly. You know, and then so he can get the glory. So I'm just like, so I knew I just had to go through what I would go through. And I would just pray to God, just please, whatever. And I remember I would pray for action because I talked about living clean while I was getting high. I thought about living clean while I was getting high. I had dreams about it, and I would pray for action. You know, because we really do need to do our part. And that's that last day. And I remember telling my mom and dad, just pray for action. And the last day that I used, on February 16th, 2006, I was walking down the street and I was praying for action. And that's when I got picked up by the police. And that's when I knew this is my opportunity to do something different. The not yet is over. It's time. Mm-hmm.
Dillian, I remember in your book, you said when you were arrested, I think it was that time, the police couldn't believe because you were saying, thank you, thank you.
Yeah, I was thanking. I was like, oh, thank God. You know, like, it's over. It's done. And they were like, what is wrong? You know, you're going to jail, right? And I'm like, that, because I knew once I got a couple clean days under my belt, I knew how to get clean and, you know, do something different. I knew I just couldn't get an hour clean. I couldn't get 2 hours clean, because every time I said I wasn't going to use today, somebody would bring some free stuff or something would happen. I would end up, and I was living in a crack house. Like, who's not going to use in a crack house? That's like going to a barbershop every day saying I'm not going to get a haircut, you know?
But even then, when we had talked earlier, I'd asked you, what was the bottom for you?
It was the spiritual bankruptcy,
right.
You know, just walking around like a zombie. I was empty inside. Just
you had stopped using drugs by then. I remember you telling me, right.
And just miserable. And that's what it was, like a walking zombie. And kind of like when they talk about in Revelations, just like, that's what it was. That's exactly what I felt like. That's why today I'm like, my worst day clean is so much better than my best day getting high. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if that makes any sense, mm-hmm. You know, because it's just like a circle, just using, getting done using, and you have the feeling of, what are you going to do now? Then it's that anxiety, that depression. And then you got to start planning and going to get something else. And then the things that you do to get drugs, and then you feel shame, and then you use. And so it's just around and around and around. And when I just really got to face my feelings and live life on life's terms, I got to show up to life.
Right.
I can't keep hiding from life.
So kind of like the book, we spent all this time talking about all the struggles you went through. And please, people, read the book, because we're not even coming close to talking about what happened in Delina's life. But the last part of the book is like, it's like a different story.
Yeah.
So there's the personal part, kind of like, how did you do that? But there's also the, you got the system to help you get educated and you got a license?
Yes. I had to jump through some hoops to get a license.
So if you could talk a little about the personal transformation and also what you had to do with the system and how it helped you or got in the way or whatever.
So when you take the drugs away from a person who is using, you still have like the behaviors and the lifestyle. I wanted to change. And that's what recovery, I wanted more than being abstinent. I wanted to recover. And active recovery is changing the way that I think and my behaviors and my attitude. So that's what I had to do. I really had to change everything, you know, because my first response to things was inappropriate. If I see somebody dropping some money, I'm picking it up and putting it in my pocket. Like I had to change things like that. When I have some money, I'm not going to cop. I'm going to get, I mean, at the time I was smoking cigarettes or putting some money up or buying some food. Mm-hmm. So it was like a psychic mind change that I had to go through. And the Jennifer House helped me with that. And also with the feelings, I had to endure my feelings. So I had a lot of inside work to work on. On many days, I was walking around like a dressed up garbage can. I was doing my hair. I was taking baths. I was dressed well, but on the inside, I was just ew, you know, because of my thinking, my behaviors, and my attitude. So that's what had to change. And that comes with the self-acceptance, the self-awareness, and the integrity, the spiritual principles. Mm-hmm. So once I got a little foundation in that, and I need to say that I had a lot of help because I didn't do this alone. I had, God put so many people in my life. The Spiritus Christi, I'm about to tear up, the Spiritus Christi community is the bomb in Rochester. They are so active. And I don't say that just because they helped me to save my life and I work there, but like they really walk out their mission. And that's why I liked working there, because my mission, my personal values was aligned with their mission. Mm-hmm. You know, so they had a team of people from the Jennifer House, from the church and everything that like helped me to, because I slid under the door. I was on my belly. So they kind of helped me to get on my knees. And then I went to the YWCA and God put some more people in my life that kind of helped me to stand. And I was a little wobbly. And then I had people like threatening me and bullying me to go to school, to do good things. And so I went to school. I remember I went to, and I was so scared. I was scared to take the Accuplacer. I was trying to study for that test. And they're like, you don't study for the Accuplacer, Delina. Just go take the test. The Accuplacer, you take that, and that's how they know where to place you. I graduated with an AA degree in 2 years at Monroe Community College. I was one of the first graduates of the drug addiction program there, counseling program, when they started that. And I graduated with the 4.0 top 15 of my class. And that's because of like the support that I had around me and my ability to ask for help.
Do you remember how old you were?
You never ask a woman that question. It was in 2009 when I graduated, and what, I'm 48 or 40 something now, 47. You can do the math.
So 30 in your 30s. Okay.
Yeah. So I, and my ability to ask for help and to say, I don't know. But I remember when I first, and this is in the book, because when I first went to go sign up for the class, this woman was asking me these questions about me to help me. And I didn't have any answers to the questions because I didn't know. And instead of saying, I don't know, I just started crying and I just walked out of there. And then I saw a friend of mine who has some disabilities, and we talk a lot of junk together, and God forbid, rest in peace, he passed away. But I'm like, if he can do this, like, I know I can do this. So I walked back in there and I answered her questions. I said, I don't know. And then she was able to help me. So I think that's a strength. Two of my strengths, my ability to say, I don't know, and my ability to ask for help. And then Judy Simpson, the woman at the Jennifer House, she was the founder, one of the founders of the Jennifer House. She said, well, now that you went through MCC, we have a scholarship for you at another college. You got to go on. I was like, but I wasn't thinking about that. And I think the only reason I chose Nazareth, because our board meetings are there and they have pretty purple and yellow tulips.
Okay.
I didn't know of many colleges, you know, I didn't know anything about college. So and that's kind of started my journey. And then I was like, you know, I might as well go on and do the accelerated program and do another 2 years and get my master's, you know. But everybody was telling me I wasn't going to get my license because of my criminal history.
Right.
You know, even from the professors on down to some people administrations at the school. But I did my research and found out that all the Board of Social Work wants to know is if I am of good moral character today. And I knew I was of good moral character. I knew that because I had changed my life. I think I had like almost 18 people write letters for me to get my license. And also even before that, I had to get like a certificate of good conduct. And so I had to give them all my certificates, just show proof of everything that I've done. Mm-hmm. I had an inch binder, 3-ring binder that was full of all my accomplishments and everything that I had done. And the parole officer came to my house. It's supposed to be like a 6 to 9 month program. But he said, you know, I was going through these and I saw this binder and I started looking in it. And this was like 3 months after I had applied. And he was like, I am so amazed at the things that you've done and how you've changed your life. I was able to get my certificate of good conduct. And then I just had to jump through some other hoops to get my license. But I finally was a licensed social worker in, I think I had to wait like 2 years or something before I jumped through all the hoops that they made me jump through. Mm. And then when I applied for the GRC, the master's program, I didn't know if I got accepted until 2 days before class started, because they kept saying, we don't know we're still waiting on your special circumstance. I'm like, what are you talking about? The drugs and the prostitution is just call it what it is. What special circumstances are we talking about? So I knew I've started, I think it was like a day or 2 days or so before class started, and I had to rush and get my books, but that was nothing. And that's the action part. So it's like when I came into recovery and I got a couple clean days under my belt and I had some support, you know, it's like that action. I have been in action ever since. I show up and my life is about action today. Sometimes I don't even know what the heck I'm showing up to. You know, and when I show up, God shows out. And I still do that today. If, you know, I get a little nudge and I'm like, I don't want to go, but I'm glad I did go at the end, and just helping other people. It lifts my spirit because people helped me, you know, and I think that's what this world is about. Like the human connection. It doesn't matter what color you are, where you come from or whatever, just, you know, we're all connected.
And when you
that was a long-winded answer, I'm sorry.
When you went to Minnesota, did you have to go through this again?
Yes. And I just went through renewing my license and now they want some more stuff. And I'm like, oh, here you guys go. So now I got to call back to New York and get some, but I'm just like, you guys are playing too much, but I'm used to jumping through hoops. So, and I knew my process was going to be different and it was going to be longer than other people, but I just love when people tell me I can't do something. I really do. That still applies to this day.
Right. Any other thoughts from anyone on the call?
Hi, Delina. It's Kathleen.
Hi.
Your friend, your book is so open and sharing and personal. Talk about what motivated you to tell your story.
So I never thought I would write a book. My sponsor in the 12-step program, who passed away, we would always joke about it. And Jane came into my life one day and she was like writing for the DNC and she said, oh, you should write a book. And I'm just like, yeah, you know, I will one day. And then she said, she called my bluff. Well, I'll help you. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I talked into a recorder for months and months and months, and we got it down in the paper. And I knew that if I told my story, I couldn't do it any other way. Like I couldn't censor it. It had to be butt naked, honest. I just like raw. I had to be honest, raw. And obviously there's a lot of stuff that's not in there. That's the only way I know how to tell my story. And I know that My story will help other people to understand maybe what their sister, their brother, their child, or something is going through. And I know it's helped some people because I've talked to some people. And because it's difficult to understand addiction, it is so difficult because you don't care about anything. And that's a hard concept to swallow. Because my mom used to tell me, you're losing your freaking mind. And in a sense, she was right. Like I was, my thinking was changing. But I just knew that I had to get honest. And I was like, it's out there and whoever judges me, oh, well, just is what it is. And if somebody would judge me because of my story, not taking into consideration who I am today, then they don't need to be in my life. And that's just kind of how I see it, because it's because of my experiences that I am the woman of integrity today. So that I am the woman, the mother, the daughter, the fiance, that I am the stepmother that I am today. It's because of my experiences, and I'm grateful. I wish they didn't have to happen like that, but I'm very grateful.
So you bring up a really interesting point. I told you that many of us are in a book club together, and we spent a couple of years reading a series of authors who were focusing on the theories of a Jungian analyst, James Hillman, who's kind of a renegade Jungian analyst. And I love him because I'm not sure he has any data to back up what he said. It was based on his theory and his clinical experience. So he has this interesting concept. I have to paraphrase it, but it's basically you have to grow your soul, that your spirit that's up there, but your soul comes from all the dramas of life. He was of the feeling that it isn't an accident, that you're born in the kind of drama situation that you need to have your purpose in life revealed to you, and your right. gifts, which are often embedded in all of this wounding stuff that's inside you, that it's the drama that makes you alive and grows your soul. I don't know, those of you on the call that are in the book club, is that a fair description? They're all nodding yes.
I totally agree with that. I totally yeah. agree with that.
And there's no guarantee that you're going to make it. He says that
yes.
too.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that, because without those experiences, like I matured and grew up, not only through the experiences, but healing from the experiences. I wouldn't be doing the things that I'm doing today had it not been for my experiences. I wouldn't be able to help the people that I'm helping today had it not been for my experiences. And I love my job because they come in there, they are so funny, you know, because I have this really huge, beautiful office and I have it neatly decorated and I'm this young girl and I think I'm looking okay. And they come in there and I work with people that are, I run a low income housing program. And so they come in there and they're like, but you don't understand, you know, you've never been homeless, or I just smoke crack sometimes and you don't understand, but I'm in recovery, but I used this morning. And I'm just like, you know, so like, yeah, I understand. I get it. And I read it in a book. This is how I know. I don't tell them my book, but yeah. So they're just so funny. And I love my job. I love working with that population and I'm good at it. And they don't even have to know my experiences. I just love my job. I absolutely love working with the people. They wear my butt out, but I love it. I get up and show up every day.
The other thing you've been able to do, and we were talking about this earlier, is when I was in training as a young psychiatrist, addiction was just part of the other mental health issues. And I had to do some acute detoxing of people from alcohol or certain substances. But the focus would be on, you have to save their life and you have to detox them. But then it's, what's the underlying reason why they're using? And there wasn't enough attention paid to what the drugs were doing to you. And then the pendulum swung. And then without special training, psychiatrists didn't even get to do this anymore. We were out of the picture. And specialists could do the detox. But there were a lot of often former people who were formerly addicted who knew what it was like and would get in there and really work with the people one-on-one or in groups. But the sense I had from a distance is there was very little attention paid to what was the underlying reason. It was, yeah, you're on drugs, stop this crap, get off the drugs, you have to be real. But there wasn't a lot of attention paid to what we talked about early in this podcast, like what happened to you? It also became very biological. Well, you know, it's a genetic predisposition to addiction and all of that.
Yeah.
Right. And it was also kind of a distaste. So like the psychiatrist and psychologist, in a sense, there was like kind of looking down at people who didn't have the degree, but were in the trenches. We actually didn't want to be in the trenches most of the time. But then the people in the trenches who didn't think we were worth anything because we didn't know what we were talking about because blah, 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 blah. Somehow you've put these two worlds together, right? You're in the trenches, you've been through it, and you're a licensed social worker who's proud of it.
Yes.
And you know there's something underneath, at least with some of the people, that has to be dealt with. I actually find that remarkable that you've been able to do that. Where did that level of respect come from for all of those different levels of people who are working to help in this situation?
The level of respect?
Well, I respect the work you do, and I can feel the respect you have for me for whatever experiences I had as a psychiatrist. And what I'm saying is you went and you weren't satisfied with trying to help people because of your experience in the trenches. You got a master's in social work, and then you went and got licensed, and now you're running a program.
I think the question that I'll answer a lot of that is, a lot of like the underlying issues is not like what the drugs did to a person, but I tend to ask people, what did the drugs do for you? Because they served a purpose. What purpose did they serve? And when you keep asking why eventually you'll kind of get, and once they do some work, you'll kind of get to some of those underlying issues. But it's like, what did the drugs do for you? What were you escaping? And your question was like the respect.
You didn't just buck the system or say, well, these social workers, psychiatrists don't know what they're talking about. I know what it is because I've been through it.
Okay. People do things differently. People recover differently. Different things work for different people. I know what worked for me. So I wanted some more tools in my toolbox to find different ways to help different people, which was valuable because I know earlier on, I said, you know, I believe in the disease model. And that's why I attend meetings in a 12-step program. Not everybody recovers like that. That's okay. Some people go to the church. Some people do it other ways. Some people rely on their religion, their faith, the universe, or whatever, spiritual principles. I don't know. But not everybody recovers differently. Kind of like people respond or react to things differently. So I just wanted a lot of tools in my toolbox to help people who don't want to do it the way that I did it. Always good to have like a plan B, a plan C, or a plan D. And one of the things that I noticed is when I was doing an intern at the St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center, I was a part of this women's group, and I was the only one that was in recovery. And all of the women in that circle struggled with the same issues, and they were all experts in their own right. And so I was able to come up with some assignments that I learned in recovery, but changed the language. So they didn't even know it was like recovery work, but it was internal work, you know, working on these vices that are barriers in our lives to help us to be our best selves. At the end of the day, we really all have the same issues. We just deal with them differently and we heal from them differently. And it kind of makes me think of the movie with Sandra Bullock when she was the alcoholic. I love that movie. If you haven't seen it, you got to check it out. She's hilarious. Her and her sister had the same experiences with the alcoholic mother, exact same memories, but they responded to them differently. Mm-hmm. One sister became a lawyer or some expert, and Sandra Bullock became an addict. And that's kind of like me and my family. People respond to things differently. So mm-hmm. people will heal from things differently and people will recover differently. And I just wanted more tools in my toolbox, as many as I can have to help as many people. So I pay attention to like people like psychiatry. You have some tools. I can learn from you. I can learn from Bob. I can learn from any. I can learn from a dog. I can learn how to be obedient from a dog, you know. So I just always try to stay open-minded, and I learn from the people that I serve, and I love doing it. You know, my 8-year-old teaches me a lot. Oh my gosh.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, and good luck with your book. Again, it's called God's Teardrop by Delina Harper, and you can get it at your favorite bookstore and online and as an ebook if you like it.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.